From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Frances Alonso reporting. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's Justice and Development Party appeared to be on target to pull off a surprisingly big election victory in Sunday's parliamentary polls, the second in less than 6 months, prompting accusations of voting irregularities from some opposition politicians. According to partial results broadcast by the state-run Turkish television, the AKP may have secured more than half of the vote. Opinion surveys the day before the vote suggested that Sunday's election would likely repeat June's inconclusive result, in which no party secured an outright majority. A Russian airliner that crashed in Egypt disintegrated in the air, according to an aviation official Sunday. His comments come a day after the Metrojet flight disappeared from radar over the Sinai Peninsula with 224 people on board. Nearly all of the passengers aboard that charter flight were Russian tourists returning to St. Petersburg from the Egyptian resort of Sharm el-Sheikh. Three Ukrainians were also among the dead. Emergency crews that we hear here have recovered at least 129 bodies and both the plane's black boxes, which record flight data and pilot communications. Meanwhile, emergency crews have recovered at least 129 bodies after visiting the crash site. The Russian member of the investigation team, Viktor Sorochenko, said fragments of the Airbus A321 are strewn over a large area, according to the RIA Novosti news agency in Cairo. Militants claiming affiliation to the Islamic State say they shot it down. VOA News. The Somali militant group al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for a deadly attack on a hotel in Mogadishu Sunday, leaving at least 12 people dead, including the owner of the hotel, a military commander, and two lawmakers. Authorities say the militants set off a car bomb at the entrance of the Sahafi Hotel in Somalia's capital. Following that blast, gunmen stormed the hotel. The Somali security minister told VOA that the attackers, all of whom were killed by security forces, were wearing Burundian military uniforms and says they're investigating to determine their exact identification. Meanwhile, an al-Shabaab spokesman claimed responsibility for that attack in a statement Sunday. Police in Bangladesh say they're investigating a local radical Islamist group in the latest deadly attacks on two publishers in the capital of Dhaka. Senior police officials say they suspect the banned group Ansarullah Bangla Team carried out Saturday's attacks. However, another militant group, Al-Qaeda in the Indian subcontinent, also claim responsibility. Publisher Ahmed Rahim Tutol and two writers were shot and stabbed by three men in their offices at a publishing house Saturday in Dhaka. All three were hospitalized, one in critical condition, according to police. The second attack, publisher Faisal Arifandipan of the Jigriti Prokashoni Publishing House was found hacked to death in his office. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry met Sunday with Uzbekistan's President Islam Karimov. It's a rare high-level U.S. encounter with the autocratic ruler and the frequent target of human rights criticism. Kerry thanked Karimov for hosting the first gathering of the C5+1.
Great challenge that all of us face today regarding security. We know that your concerns about Afghanistan are concerns that we share, the stability of Afghanistan, the willingness of all of the allies to stay the course and to help fight for that stability, as well as the challenge of radical religious extremism.
The two held talks in Samarkand on the fringes of a diplomatic gathering of his five Central Asian counterparts, the United States included, as well as Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan. German Chancellor Angela Merkel failed Sunday to resolve differences within her ruling coalition on dealing with the crisis over the huge refugee influx, leaving an open dispute that has dented her conservatives' popularity. Germany has long been a magnet for migrants and expects 800,000 and a million asylum seekers to arrive this year. I'm Frances Alonso.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, can Israelis and Palestinians make peace? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. November marks the 20th anniversary of the assassination of Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin by a Jewish extremist. For many, the murder of Rabin, the man who championed the Oslo Peace Accords, foreshadowed the death of the peace process. A new book by journalist Dan Efron chronicles what he sees are the mistakes that followed Yitzhak Rabin's 1995 assassination. While incremental progress has been made since 1995, many attempts to reach a conflict-ending agreement have failed, from U.S. President Bill Clinton's Camp David summit in 2000 to the 2008 offer by former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert to the recently aborted efforts at jump-starting talks by U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry. In fact, in his address to the U.N. General Assembly in late September, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas announced that Palestine was no longer bound to previous agreements, including the Oslo Peace Accords. Moreover, the Palestinians are divided between the Hamas-controlled Gaza Strip and Palestinian Authority-controlled West Bank, and we are witnessing a fresh wave of violence between Palestinians and Israelis, particularly in Jerusalem, sparked by allegations that Israel is threatening to take over the control of the East Jerusalem holy site, known to Muslims as the Al-Aqsa Mosque and to Jews as the Temple Mount. A spate of stabbings of Israelis by Palestinians and the retaliatory actions against Palestinians by the Israeli security forces have resulted in more than 90 deaths in the month of October and left people on edge. The violence prompted UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon to urge both sides to take steps to de-escalate the situation. Recently, Secretary of State John Kerry helped broker an agreement between Israel and Jordan that entails installing video surveillance at the Al-Aqsa compound, Temple Mount, to refute claims that Israel wants to change the rules that allow Muslims to pray there, but not Jews, and also to show where the provocations are really coming from. The rising tide of violence has sparked talks about the possibility of a third intifada and makes the prospects of reaching a two-state solution anytime soon look dismal at best. Well, with us to discuss the escalating tensions and violence between Israelis and Palestinians, and if there is any silver lining in the current turmoil, we turn to two distinguished analysts. Nathan Sachs is a fellow in the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, and that's a think tank based in Washington. And Greith Alomari is senior fellow specializing in the U.S.-Israel strategic relationship at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He was formerly executive director of the American Task Force on Palestine. Nathan Sachs joins us from a studio at the Brookings Institution. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And Gaith Alomari, welcome to the program here in the studio.
Thanks.
Well, let me begin with you, Gaith. And before I ask you both questions, Gaith, of course, is a Palestinian by birth and Nathan is Israeli by birth, but either one are not speaking on behalf of either side, but rather bringing to bear their keen insights of both populations. So first to you, Gaith Alomari, what is your reaction to the current spate of violence in Jerusalem? And to what extent do you think efforts to diffuse these tensions will take effect?
To look at the effectiveness of efforts to diffuse, you have to understand what caused this. And you actually captured it in your introduction. On the one hand, we had the trigger, what's happening on the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Temple Mount, the fears that this engendered in everyone. But this came on top of an already tense situation, a tense situation whereby, let's put it this way, my generation, people who were born in the 60s, 70s, 80s, we remember Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat's handshake in the White House. We remember hope. The generation that was born in the 90s only remembers failure, all of these failed attempts that you mentioned in the introduction. And therefore, this comes after years of occupation and a Palestinian public that feels no particular hope of things moving forward. And complicating this is the failure of the Palestinian leadership to provide a model. The Palestinian Authority has been suffering from corruption and mismanagement and really has no program to its public. So this is the complex reality. In the short term, what we saw recently with the attempts to diffuse in the Temple Mount will certainly help bring the temperature down. But unless we deal with the root causes, we are bound to face these kinds of incidents over and over and over again.
Turning to you, Nathan Sachs, for your take on the current spate of violence, the root causes as well as the more proximate ones.
As I had said, I think it's a combination of both. We have, on the one hand, proximate causes, tension over Temple Mount, the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And Temple Mount, or Haram al-Sharif in Arabic, is wider than just the mosque itself. It includes also the Dome of the Rock, where two Jewish temples stood thousands of years ago, and in a sense encapsulates the conflict more than anywhere else. It's the holiest site for Jews, but barred for entry for most Orthodox Jews. But it's also one of the most holiest sites for Muslims. And as a result, it's been the focal point of clashes many times in the past. In particular, the Second Intifada was sparked by a visit by then opposition leader Ariel Sharon, Israeli opposition leader, to the Temple Mount. And time and time again, in fact, if we go back to the 20s, the 1920s, then to the first spates of violence, long before there was an Israel, had to do with what was then called as well the status quo around the Temple Mount and the Wailing Wall, the Western Wall, just to the west of the Temple Mount. And so this is the proximate cause, and it's been a powder keg for a long time, the holiest site in the region, and one that brings this conflict from a national place to a religious place, a very dangerous one to my mind. But there's a wider context, of course, and the wider context is the stalemate, the very deep sense of impasse on the diplomatic side. It's not just that the two sides failed to reach peace, it's that more and more people on both sides, especially the Palestinian, but the Israeli as well, are now feeling that there really isn't much hope of a two-state solution in this near future, or perhaps ever. And therefore, there's kind of a sense of puzzlement of what might come in its place. The general sense and the general fear is that more of the same is what's coming now. And this leads to despair, what Leith also described on the Palestinian side. For Israelis, too, a sense that this isn't going anywhere much and that there's not much point to diplomatic efforts. It boils down, in a sense, to what we're seeing now, a very troubling situation, one especially focused on Jerusalem, which is a unique situation. Unlike the West Bank, which is divided between Israeli rule and Palestinian rule, but most Palestinian people are ruled by the Palestinian Authority, in East Jerusalem, Israel has full control, but it's not fully incorporated into Israel. And as a result, we have a bit of a no man's land, and that's where we're seeing the violence right now.
Back to you, Ghaith Al-Omari, before we get into the underlying causes, back to this Al-Aqsa Mosque, Temple Mount dispute. Of course, we hear Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu say that the status quo has not changed and will not change, but oftentimes these words aren't met by actions on the ground. You see perhaps groups over which he doesn't have much control, some very Orthodox Jews or extremist groups who do challenge, as Natan Saks said, they go to the Temple Mount, they provoke. What do you think can be done besides the cameras, and how about this discrepancy between words and deeds?
There are two categories of deeds that we see which are counterproductive, from the Israeli side at least. The first one, I would say, are, as you mentioned, the extremist groups that are beyond anyone's control. You can try to tamp them down and whatnot, but there's not much you can do about them, except in certain cases when they cross a certain line, they can and should be banned. But the more problematic one is when you start seeing provocative action coming from Israeli officials. The current round started by a visit by actually an Israeli cabinet minister to the site. A day after the Jordan, the U.S. and Israel reached the agreement on the holy site and the cameras, the Israeli deputy foreign minister made a very provocative statement. And this requires decisive action by the prime minister. So this is what needs to be done on the one hand. But on the other hand, and this is a deeper problem, one of the reasons that people do not believe the statements of the prime minister is that we have a very deep crisis of trust between the two sides. And this is not one that you can overcome by simple statements. You need deeds, not only deeds on the Haram al-Sharif, the Temple Mount, but also deeds by the Israeli government in the wider West Bank and in the Gaza Strip to show that there is an Israeli government that might not be willing to do peace today, but is committed to the idea of a two-state solution. Of course, there is a set of reciprocal action that we need from the Palestinian side. But unless we look at the wider context and deal with the trust deficit through constructive action, I fear that neither side will be convinced by the other side's statements and policies.
Natan Saks, well, speaking of the prime minister, he also had quite an outrageous statement recently, Benjamin Netanyahu, suggesting that the World War II era Mufti was responsible for inspiring Adolf Hitler to exterminate European Jewry. I mean, these kinds of statements certainly don't help, do they?
No, they absolutely do not. First, it's in this case very important to state the simple facts. It is factually false. It is not true. About 80% of Lithuania's Jews, I'm actually myself three-quarters Lithuanian, were exterminated before the Mufti ever met Hitler. Hitler was the man behind the extermination of Jews. The Mufti was a rabid anti-Semite and was a cheerleader for the Holocaust, but to claim that he was behind it is factually false and preposterous. And most people in Israel, it should be made very clear, responded with amazement at the prime minister's assertion, which I think was done offhand. But this is part of the general sense of very deep mistrust. On Temple Mount, for example, there have been some very troubling acts by Israeli politicians on the far right, including visits to Temple Mount. But we should put it in context. That is often taken as an attempt by Israel to destroy the mosque or to radically change the ability of Muslims to pray there. And these things are not true. The status quo as we have since 67 has been that the Israeli authorities themselves have decided to limit the ability of Jews to pray on Temple Mount. So Jews are barred from praying on Temple Mount. In part, this coincides with a prohibition for many Orthodox. In fact, the most Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox Jews, do not believe that Jews are allowed to enter the Temple Mount because they fear that they would accidentally enter what was the Holy of Holies of the Temple, something that only the high priest could do once a year on Yom Kippur. And as a result, the most Orthodox do not even go up. But some of the national Orthodox, the national religious, tend to be the most nationalist among Israelis, although not only. Some of them do believe that some of the Temple Mount can be entered and is the holiest site, of course, for Jews, and would like to pray there. So many of them are framing this as a religious freedom issue, as one where they should be allowed to pray there as just anyone else would be. And this is very difficult for Israelis to counter. Of course, the counter is that despite the fact that it does limit their religious freedom, it is very dangerous for peace. And so the result is that then when you get people like the deputy foreign minister and others who go up there and sometimes pray quietly before the police ask them to leave, you get people among Palestinians and others who claim that Israel is about to destroy the foundations of the mosque, to bring it down, all these things which just are wild claims that are unrelated to reality. As you pointed out, though, when you get rhetoric that goes back to the Holocaust and things like this, when it becomes so heated and so divorced from reality, it feeds on itself, I'm afraid.
Back to you, Reith Al-Omari. So we have incitement on the Israeli side, outrageous statements, visits to Haram al-Sharif, which are provocative, but there's certainly a lot of incitement in the Palestinian media and social media. What role do they play, in your view, in helping to incite violence, these horrible stabbings?
You have two sources of incitement. One is predictable and understandable, is the one that comes from those who intentionally want to inflame, like Hamas, like some of these extremist terrorist organizations. You could expect them to do that. What is more troubling to me and what's more surprising and which should be countered effectively is when it comes from Palestinian leaders who are professing commitment to peace, people like President Abbas, who perpetuates these kinds of myths that Natan mentioned, knowing that this is not the truth. Now, why does he do that? He does that because he's a president who feels that his legitimacy is lacking, and therefore he wants to take a hardline position to, if you wish, pander to his public. The problem with this, of course, it feeds the worst instincts and the worst tendencies among Palestinians and does translate into this unrest. So this incitement coming from Hamas and the like, not much we can do about it, but to counter it with facts. The incitement that comes from Palestinian officials who believe in a two-state solution, they should be called on it. And this is, I think, one of the things where the U.S. and some of our Arab allies should play a role in telling the Palestinian leaders, yes, we understand your political impulse, but this is unacceptable in principle, and it's counterproductive because it produces the kind of violence that undermines the very goal you're intending to achieve.
Well, back to you, Natan, before we go to a break. What do you have to add or subtract to the amount of incitement that we're seeing in the Palestinian media, social media, and even coming from some of the leaders like Mahmoud Abbas?
This is, of course, a byproduct of just the deep lack of trust, the sense of impasse and stalemate that Reith and I referred to earlier. It's a very sad state of affairs. When you think 20 years ago this week, the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, those days were a very special time, a special time sort of in world affairs. There was this moment, unipolar moment, in a sense that things were being solved. Eastern Europe was going through a beautiful revolution or succession of revolutions. And it seemed like maybe in the Middle East, too, things would be solved. That's not quite the mood in the world today. It's definitely not the mood in the Middle East. Among Israelis and Palestinians, we've really seen all that hope disappear and instead a very deep sense of cynicism. And in this atmosphere of cynicism, wild claims such as the ones we just mentioned can be believed. They don't meet each other much anymore as they used to. They mostly see each other in the context of the conflict. And this feeds on this very insightful but also very damaging atmosphere of both populations to one another, and I should add, by many people outside looking inside at Palestinians and Israelis and willing to believe almost anything.
We'll be back in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Natan Sachs, from whom you just heard. He's a fellow in the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, and Reith Al-Omari. He's senior fellow specializing in the U.S.-Israel strategic relationship at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. We're talking about the upsurge in deadly violence between Israelis and Palestinians, especially in Jerusalem, and what can be done to ease tensions. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA, or connect with us on Facebook. Well, back to you, Reith Al-Omari, to now look at the underlying causes, the wider context for the violence. We've seen succession of potential peace deals dissipate, the latest attempts by Secretary of State John Kerry. And I was recently talking with the UN Special Envoy for Middle East Peace Process at the United Nations, Mladenov, and he's saying both sides have major obstacles. On the Israeli side, they have to look at withdrawing from the occupied territories. The Palestinians have to come close together. You can't have Hamas ruling the Gaza Strip and the Palestinian Authority, the West Bank. There has to be unity. I mean, it's a dismal situation right now, but are any steps being taken on the Palestinian side to try to unify?
No. The short answer is no. The long answer is both Hamas in Gaza and the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank pretend that they want to unify. In reality, they have no interest. I would even add that I see unity right now between the two movements as impossible and even as undesirable. Because you have two movements that have opposed objectives. The Palestinian Authority wants a two-state solution, the Palestinian state living side by side with Israel, achieved via diplomacy and peaceful means. Hamas wants the destruction of Israel using violence. So you cannot really have unity on these terms. But what you can do in the meantime is make sure that one of the two narratives wins, the narrative of peace or the narrative of violence. If we allow right now diplomacy and peaceful means to pay dividend, then those in the West Bank, in the Palestinian Authority who want a two-state solution, can have a degree of legitimacy. Now, how do you give them dividends? Right now, clearly, a peace deal is not possible for political reasons in Israel and Palestine, but things can be done on the ground. Life for the Palestinians in the West Bank is not pleasant, to put it diplomatically. Things can be done to lighten the footprint of the occupation, allow economic development, allow freedom of movement. These kind of things, yes, they will not bring us a two-state solution, but will convince Palestinians that Israelis are serious in taking steps towards a two-state solution. The second thing that needs to be done is to look at the Palestinian Authority itself. Yes, they are committed to a two-state solution, yet their record of governance has been dismal. Corruption, bad governance, closing the political space, all of these things. For the Palestinian Authority to rehabilitate itself, it has to start looking at reform, at democratization, because if you rehabilitate the messenger, in this case the Palestinian Authority, you also rehabilitate the message, and in this case it is the two-state solution. So a combination of Palestinian internal steps and steps by Israel at the moment to show that Israel is still committed to peace through action on the ground could take us a long way.
Quickly before I turn to Natan, I wanted to ask you, because this comes up among Israelis and even Jews around the world, do you think fundamentally the Palestinians are resigned to accepting a Jewish state, that is the state of Israel, within territory after, you know, swaps are made? Because there's still now a revival of the sense that the Arab world, the Palestinians in particular, really just will not accept anything but entire territory of Palestine.
It really depends on what you mean by that question. If you mean that the Palestinians, after a peace deal, will become Zionists and will love Israel and will sing the Israeli national anthem, of course not. But to me, that is not important. The question is, can you have a peace deal that will be stable, that will give the Palestinians and Israelis enough, imperfect, but will give them enough to be satisfied with? My answer is yes. I look at the peace treaty between Egypt and Israel. I will challenge you to find more than a handful of Egyptians who actually like Israel. Yet the peace treaty has survived since the late 1979 until now, during very, very tough times, including a Muslim Brotherhood government in Egypt. Why? Not because Egyptians like Israel or think that Israel, you know, is a fantastic thing, but because they feel that this peace treaty is in the interest of their nation. And if we can create such a dynamic between Palestinians and Israelis, to me that is sufficient.
Turning to you, Natan Sachs, now it's your turn to talk about steps that need to be taken and particularly on the Israeli side, do you see any appetite for confidence-building steps that could help reduce the violence on the Palestinian side, reduce the occupation in the West Bank in particular?
The short answer, I am afraid, is also no. The slightly longer answer is it's a bit more complicated. You don't have a sense of appetite now among Israelis to make any gesture of goodwill towards the Palestinians. There's a very strong sense of fear. Everyone I speak to on the ground is very much afraid. If you think of the word terrorism, that's kind of the point, to create fear. And this wave of violence, a very low-tech wave of violence, sort of lone attackers with knives mostly, has actually succeeded very remarkably in this, I'm sorry to say. And so, and in that environment, if you think of fear on the streets, fear of running your own daily life, that's not an environment conducive to making political gestures or making any kind of experiment whatsoever, and certainly not feeling goodwill towards Palestinians and others. On the other hand, the Israeli public can be surprisingly pragmatic with the right leadership in the right moment. So despite what I just said, if there were leadership on both sides that was able to make some kind of concrete move towards reducing the tension, towards reducing the Israeli presence in the West Bank, I have very little doubt that the Israeli public could be swayed to support this. But it needs leadership that believes in this kind of thing. I think on both sides it's very lacking. And so we're really thinking about the next leadership, and I don't know what it would be like. On the Israeli side, we have a leadership that is very, very cautious, is one that does not believe that this conflict can be solved fundamentally, and to my mind has an all-or-nothing approach, a bit like what Reith described earlier, a belief that if Palestinians cannot be swayed to believe in the Zionist cause, to believe that Jews have a right to a state in the Holy Land, etc., then peace isn't worth it at all. And to my mind, peace is a much smaller word than that. It is not reconciliation and deep belief in each other's narratives. It is an agreement to disagree, but not to kill each other while doing it. In other words, we cannot have everything we hoped for. We cannot have beautiful reconciliation, but rather we can have practical steps and perhaps even a peace deal that sees peace in a much more modest way. Steps to start with would include, of course, a limitation on Israeli construction, something that actually quietly Netanyahu has already began to do. And secondly, an attempt to enlarge dramatically the contiguity of Palestinian-controlled territory, their possibility to run their own lives, to allow daily life on the small, mundane, bureaucratic things, things that don't make headlines, that would not satisfy any demonstrators anywhere, but would actually allow Palestinians to have a much better life.
Well, as we close, back to you, Reith Al-Omari. Both of you have echoed that we need new leadership, but short of leadership, that leads us to ask about the role of outsiders. What about the so-called Arab Peace Initiative that people are now resuscitating, saying that, you know, if 22 Arab states can help bring about peace between Israelis and Palestinians, this would help enormously for the region. Many say there are many points of convergence now between many of the Sunni Arab states and Israel. When you look at the context in the region, the rise of Iran and the situation in Syria, do you think it can be a catalyst?
There is definitely convergence of interest between the Sunni Arab states and Israel, and we have seen below the radar screen, in closed rooms, very intensive security and intelligence cooperation and military cooperation even. Yet to think that this will transform into open cooperation between Israel and the Arab world, we're not quite there yet. Where the Arabs will deliver and can deliver, and I think have an interest in delivering, is in pushing the Palestinians to take more responsible rhetoric. And we've actually seen the Jordanians play a very important role in this recently. And in pushing the Palestinians and giving them cover to do more difficult steps, as it were.
The last word to you, Natan Sachs, about this regional approach, and how key, in your view, is it?
I think it's true that a regional strategy is crucial, and I think certainly the Arab Peace Initiative can be a good component, a good platform on which to have this discussion. But it doesn't solve the problems themselves. It's all conditioned on the idea that the Palestinians and the Israelis reach a deal. Same is true now with this convergence of interests. Israelis and the Sunni Arabs certainly have an interest, in part because they see a common enemy in Iran. But that does not mean that they have any new solutions to Jerusalem, any new solutions to refugees, any new solutions to all the other issues of final status. So I certainly think it's an important component, but let's not put our hopes too high on the Arab states being more Palestinian than Palestinian, or being able to convince the Palestinians or the Israelis to change their fundamental views on what they see as their fundamental interests.
Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Natan Sachs. He's a fellow in the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, and Reith Al-Omari. He's senior fellow specializing in the U.S.-Israel strategic relationship at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Dave Magnus, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the Voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to As It Is, our daily magazine program. I'm Anna Mateo. Today is the first day of November. Many people celebrated Halloween Saturday night. Halloween celebrations are very popular in the United States. In the Washington, D.C. area, we are enjoying beautiful autumn weather. Leaves on the trees are changing color, turning yellow, red, or orange, and the weather is starting to cool down. This is the time when many people bring out their cold weather clothes, boots, scarves, hats, sweaters, and long pants. And today, that is what we will be talking about, clothes. If you had a choice, would you buy a low-cost article of clothing, one that doesn't cost much but is of less than average quality? Or are you more likely to spend more money and buy something of higher quality? That is what Kelly Jean Kelly explores in her story today. Let's listen as she describes the differences between what critics are calling fast fashion and slow fashion.
A few years ago, Maxine Bedat, who is now in her early 30s, looked in her closet. It was full of clothes, but she had nothing to wear.
And that was because it was a closet full of fast fashion that was falling apart, that was based on hyper trends from one season to the next.
Fast fashion means clothes that are inexpensive, but look like the latest designs from top fashion houses. Well-known fast fashion stores include H&M, Forever 21, Zara, and Topshop. One reason for the success of fast fashion is social media. A report by the investment research firm Bernstein found that millennials, people born in the 1980s and 90s, want to wear a variety of clothes in the photos they post on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. As a result, many businesses that offer trendy, low-cost clothes are growing. But some millennials are not happy with the rise of fast fashion. Maxine Bedat, the woman with the closet full of clothes but nothing to wear, calls fast fashion exhausting. She says she was tired of always shopping for what was in style. Instead, she says, she wanted to buy fewer clothes that she could wear over and over. Other people wanted the same thing, she says.
I just saw a post today from one of the biggest bloggers, and it's, what is her favorite white t-shirt? And I think that's really, you know, telling about where we are today. It's not just about having something new every single day, but what is something that's beautiful and what is something that's quality, and what brands do we want to be wearing that reflect the values that we hold?
So Ms. Bedat and a business partner, Saraya Darabi, started a slow fashion clothing company called Zaidi. Slow fashion means clothes that last a long time. They are often classic colors and shapes and are made from natural materials that are biodegradable over time.
Thanks, Kelly. Now we will take a short break. When we return, we will hear the rest of Kelly's report. Welcome back to As It Is from VOA Learning English. Today's show is about fashion. There was a trend, a popular movement, in the U.S. for fast fashion. Fast fashion means clothes that don't cost much. But that trend is changing, and fast. People now seem to want clothes that are made well, and that will last longer. Part of the reason is to keep clothes out of landfills. We continue now with Kelly Jean Kelly's report.
The terms fast fashion and slow fashion are related to fast food and slow food. Fast food is still popular in the U.S., but many restaurants increasingly offer higher quality, more expensive, and relaxed meals. Like slow food, slow fashion also aims to use sources that are good for the environment and workers. Maxine Bedat says, people in her generation want to know where their clothes come from and who is making them. Their interest comes in part after a clothing factory collapsed in Bangladesh in 2013. Over 1,000 people who were making cheap clothes in poor conditions died. To answer millennials' demand for information about the products they buy, Ms. Bedat's company, Zaidi, includes details about the history of the brands. It also describes the process by which the clothes are made. Ms. Bedat says, Zaidi aims to tell shoppers where their clothes come from, where they go, and how they impact the world. The international business H&M is answering millennials' demands for stylish but sustainable fashion in another way. It has created a recycling program for clothes. The program invites people to bring clothes they no longer want to H&M stores. Shoppers who donate old clothes can receive a discount on new things they buy. H&M does several things with shoppers' old clothes. They sell some clothes again. They turn some clothes into other useful items, such as cleaning cloths. And they reduce the rest to fibers that can be reused as building materials, for instance. An H&M spokesperson wrote in an email to VOA that the program aims to help the environment. We have a clear vision to avoid and minimize waste that goes into landfills, the spokesperson wrote. H&M reported that in 2014, it collected over 7,600 tons of unwanted clothing. That is about 38 million t-shirts. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And I'm Anna Mateo. Thanks for listening. You can hear another As It Is tomorrow, both as a podcast and on the radio. But don't go away. Coming up next, we have a special report for the Halloween season on words and their stories, followed by the program People in America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
Now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. In an earlier program, we talked a lot about the devil. In many religions, the devil is the most powerful spirit of evil. Religious leaders teach that hell is where the devil lives. They also say hell is the place where bad people go after they die. You can hear many Americans using the words devil and hell in everyday expressions. But the list of expressions is just too long for one show. So get ready for the sequel, what we're calling Part 2, Hell, the Devil's Hangout. Many people think of hell as a hot place full of fire. So a snowball would not have much of a chance there. And that is where this expression comes from, a snowball's chance in hell. Let's say you applied for a promotion at work, but so did your boss's daughter. You do not have a snowball's chance in hell. Your boss is not going to hire you over his daughter. It will be a cold day in hell, and when hell freezes over, also mean the same thing. There is no chance that something will happen. For example, if you have a fight with a friend and never want to talk to him again, you could say, "It will be a cold day in hell before I ever call him again. Our friendship is over." Or, "Sure, I'll call him when hell freezes over." But be careful. These expressions are very informal and very strong. You would only use them with your close friends and peers. So if your boss asks if your work will be done before you go home, you would never say, "It'll be a cold day in hell when that happens," unless you want to lose your job. Sometimes we just use the expression hell like this. "She's a hell of a dancer. He's a hell of a writer. That was a hell of a good time." Hell of a runs together as if it's one word, hell of a. Again, this is very slang and very informal. Hell is reported to be not only hot, but miserable. So if something is going to hell in a handbasket, it is becoming very bad very quickly. If you have been to hell and back, you have been through a very difficult period and lived to tell about it. Here is an example.
"I'm glad to see that Julie is back to her old self."
"Me too. She's been through so much this past month. Her mom died, her son got really sick, and then she was in that terrible car accident."
"Wow. She has really been to hell and back."
But if you do want to visit hell, there is a road you can take, the road of good intentions. Let me explain. When we say the road to hell is paved with good intentions, we mean that positive intentions may have negative outcomes. Paved here means to line a street. So the road to hell is lined with well-intended ideas that went terribly wrong. You do not have to have good intentions to be hell on wheels. People who are hell on wheels are aggressive, tough, mean, or just difficult to deal with. For example, watch out for the new woman in sales. She's good, but she is hell on wheels. Stay out of her way. Being hell on wheels is different than raising hell. People who are hell on wheels might actually be doing a good job. But if you are raising hell, you are simply behaving badly. Let's listen to this dialogue.
When she was a teenager, she really raised hell.
Tell me about it. She skipped school, got into trouble every weekend. What a hellraiser.
Her poor parents.
If you raised too much hell in one place, you may find you need to leave that place, like a bat out of hell. In other words, crazy fast. I'm Ana Mateo.
Now, the VOA Special English Program, People in America. I'm Steve Ember. In the early days of the last century, an American doctor wrote about the Native American people called the Lakota, or Sioux. His name was Charles Eastman. He was one of the few people to ever win the trust of the old people. He could do this because he, too, was a Lakota Sioux. His Lakota name was Ohiyasa. When Ohiyasa was 15 years old, he was sent to an American school for Indian children. He was given the English name Charles Eastman. He did very well in school. He was chosen to go on to college and then to medical school. He returned to his tribe as their medical doctor. In the early part of the past century, Charles Eastman saw that many of the old people were dying. He feared their history and culture would die with them. He talked to many of the very old members of the Sioux. He put their words down on paper. One of these stories was about a famous Indian fighter named Rain in the Face. This is the story that Dr. Eastman wrote.
About 2 months before the great Sioux warrior Rain in the Face died, I went to see him for the last time. "Friend," I said, "at home, when the old men were asked to tell the brave things they had done, the tobacco pipe was passed. So come, let us smoke now to the memory of the old days." He took some of my tobacco and filled his long pipe. The old man lay on a small bed covered by a red blanket. He was all alone that day. Only an old dog lay silent by his feet. Finally, he looked up and began telling me about his long life.
"I was born near the Cheyenne River about 70 years ago. My family were not great chiefs, but they were good warriors and great hunters. I was given the name Rain in the Face as a young man. This was after a great battle when we were on a warpath against the Gros Ventre tribe. I had painted my face with war paint that day. I had wished my face to represent the sun when partly covered with darkness, so I painted it half black, half red. We fought all day in the rain, and some of the war paint on my face was washed away. Much of the black and red paint had run together, so I was given the name Rain in the Face. We Sioux considered it an honorable name."
As he told his story, old Rain seemed to come alive. He smiled as he talked. He seemed younger, and his eyes shined.
One of the most daring attacks that we ever made was against the army base called Fort Totten in North Dakota. The fight took place in the summer of 1866. I had a special friend then. His name was Wapepe. He was known to the white men as Fearless Bear. He was the bravest man among us. In those days, Wapepe and I called each other brother friend. This was a life and death promise among the Sioux. What one does, the other must do. And that meant that I must be with him in the attack. And if he was killed, I must fight until I died also. I prepared for death. I painted my face with my special sign, half red, half black. Now, the signal for the attack was given. My horse started even with Wapepe, but his horse was faster than mine. This was bad for me. By the time I came close to the fort, the soldiers had somewhat recovered from the surprise of our attack. They were aiming their guns more carefully. Their guns talked very loud, but hit few of us. Their guns were like an old dog with no teeth who makes much noise and becomes more angry the more noise he makes. How much harm we did, I do not know. When the fight was finished, I saw blood on my leg. Both my horse and I were wounded.
I knew that Rain in the Face had taken part in two of the most famous fights with white soldiers. One of these fights was near an army fort named Fort Phil Kearny in Wyoming. The other was the most famous battle between the Sioux and the American Army. Rain in the Face was in the battle against the famous Army General George Armstrong Custer. That great battle took place near the Little Bighorn River. I asked him to tell me about these two great battles.
We attacked a fort west of the Black Hills. The white soldiers called it Fort Phil Kearny. It was there we killed almost 100 soldiers. They were commanded by a captain named Fetterman. It was a big fight. Many famous chiefs were there. Crazy Horse, Sitting Bull, Red Cloud, and many young warriors, Sword, American Horse, Crow King. The plan for the battle was decided after many meetings. The main group would stay hidden from view, and a few of the bravest young men were chosen to attack a group of white men. These men were cutting wood for the fort. We were told not to kill these men, but to chase them back to the fort and then ride slowly away. We did this. A large group of soldiers commanded by Captain Fetterman followed us. They thought we were only few in number. We led them into the trap. It was a matter of a very few minutes before every soldier lay dead. The very next year, we signed a peace treaty at Fort Rice in North Dakota. Almost all the Sioux chiefs signed the treaty. The treaty said all the country north of the Republican River in Nebraska, including the Black Hills and the Bighorn Mountains, was to be always Sioux country. No white man could go there without our permission. After the treaty was signed, the white men found the yellow metal they call gold in our country. They came in great numbers. They chased away all the animals we hunted for food. We had no choice. So, for the last time, we took up arms against them. No one honored the treaty.
When the treaty failed, many hundreds of Sioux families moved north to an area that is now in the state of Montana. Rain in the Face described what happened then.
In the spring, the Sioux got together near the Tongue River. It was one of the greatest camps of the Sioux that I ever saw. We had decided to fight the white soldiers until no warrior should be left. We crossed the Tongue River to the Little Bighorn. I was eating my food one day when suddenly the long-haired soldier chief called George Custer began to attack us. It was a great surprise. I heard a Sioux war cry. I saw a warrior riding his horse at top speed, giving the warning as he came. Then we heard the sound of soldiers' guns. I seized my gun, my bow and arrows, and my stone war club. As I was about to go join the fight, I saw a group of soldiers near us at the edge of a long line of cliffs across the small river. We all got on our horses and immediately started toward those soldiers. We quickly began to surround the soldiers. When the soldiers were surrounded on two sides, with the river on the third, the order came to attack. The soldiers tried to ride the other way, but they could not leave. They fired their guns at us as fast as they could. We mostly used bows and arrows. The soldiers fought very bravely until they were killed. I had always thought that white men were not brave, but I had a great respect for them after this day. No one knows who killed the soldier chief Longhair Custer. Many lies have been told about me. Some say I killed Custer or his brother Tom Custer that day. Why, in that fight, the excitement was so great that we could not recognize our nearest friends. Everything was done as fast as lightning. But that was long ago. I have lived in peace now for many, many years. No one can say Rain in the Face has broken the rules. I fought for my people and my country. When we lost, I remained silent as a warrior should. My warrior spirit died when I put down my weapons. Now, there is only my poor body that has lived on. Now, that too is almost ready to lie down for the last time. Nah, it is well.
Rain in the Face, one of the last great Sioux warriors, died at the Standing Rock Reservation in North Dakota on September 14th, 1905.
This special English program was taken from the book Indian Heroes and Great Chieftains by Dr. Charles Eastman. Doug Johnson was the voice of Dr. Eastman. Shep O'Neill was the voice of Rain in the Face. Our program was produced by Katie Weaver. Our studio engineer was Greg Burns. I'm Steve Ember. Join us again next week for another People in America program on the Voice of America. It's music.